We discovered your roof needs a patch job. It has let a good bit of spring deluge into your sleeping quarters, which, looking on the bright side, drowned a good many of the mice. Richard will fetch new sheathing for the roof as soon as the mud dries on the road, and we can get around without miring up to our fenders. We're all assuming you and Cynthia have four-wheel drive. Well, old friend, hang in there, and content yourself with the bald truth that God is working in Jessup, Tennessee. Yours, Father Harry. P.S. A neighboring boy named Abner, as in the comic strip of yore, has come to my door looking for work. Heaven knows we can use an extra hand. It makes the heart glad to see his patient industry. Around 14, maybe 15 years old, can't read a word or write his name. Pray for Abner. Keep me posted. Send money. The eternal effervescence of Harry Rowland was more than a man could take on an empty stomach. He opened the other package of crackers and downed his low-fat milk, watching the door for a sign of his wife. Four-wheel drive. Blast! Why hadn't they thought of that? Cynthia's Mazda had front-wheel drive. Wouldn't that do the trick? What could he have been thinking these last couple of months? What kind of fog had he been in, anyway? From isbp@aol.com, my old friend, I write to you as St. Paul wrote to the Hebrews. How can we thank God enough for you in return for all the joy that we feel before our God because of you? Night and day we pray most earnestly that we may see you face to face, and restore whatever is lacking in your faith, if anything be lacking, dear brother. Now may our God and Father himself, and our Lord Jesus, direct our way to you, and may the Lord make you increase and abound in love, just as Martha and I abound in love for you. I plan to come through Mitford on 28th, en route to meeting in Charlotte. We'll see you then, unless advised to contrary. Be encouraged. Stuart. There was an appalling soreness in every limb, every joint. His eyes were as painful as if they'd been punched like a voting ballot, and his head pounding like horses at a gallop. He found his left temple bandaged, and supposed this had come about from crashing into the stop sign. He dropped the mail onto his blanket, exhausted. Perhaps the yogurt would provide some strength, but he couldn't get interested in lifting the spoon to his mouth. He rang for the nurse to take his tray so there would be room for Cynthia to sit on the bed beside him. Some flame licked up at the thought of her, and warmed him, and he lay back against the pillows and closed his eyes and tried to forget what he had done and where he was and why. His wife lay on her side next to him, her hand in his. They had been silent for some time, content merely to lie together touching. "We're a pair," he murmured at last. "What are you thinking?" "I'm thanking God for you." "What's left of me," he said, surprised at the irony in his voice. "I'm thinking about Tennessee, how they'll have to dig deep till we get there. It won't help matters to start off short-handed." "We'll think about that later." "What about the car? Did I..." "Let's talk about it later, dearest. We'll talk about everything later." Hoppy blew in with a burst of energy that scattered the emails to the floor. "Now I have two patients?" "Multiplying like coat hangers in a closet," crowed Cynthia, sitting up and tidying herself. Hoppy put his hand on Cynthia's shoulder. "Have you slept?" "Finally," she said, "but still a bit droopy." Father Tim raised his head from the pillow. "We were just talking about Tennessee, and when we might be able to..."
"You'll have to forget Tennessee," said his doctor, folding his arms across his chest. "With your out-of-control diabetes, the last thing you need is a year in the backwoods."
"Yes, but you... What if this had happened in Jessup, Father? 14 miles from the nearest hospital?"
Having no answer, he was silent.
"There's your answer," said Hoppy. Hoppy had decreed that no one but Cynthia could visit him when he moved to the floor. That suited him fine. He had nothing much to say, and less energy to say it with. The staff was conniving to stuff food into him at every turn. He felt like a goose in which someone sought to cultivate pâté. When the phone rang, he didn't answer it. Once a nurse answered and announced that J.C. Hogan was on the line. He waved the proffered receiver away, spent. Flowers poured in, roses, tulips, even a few sprigs of ivy pulled from the yard of a former parishioner and stuck into a mason jar. "Let this root," said the note. Sissy sent the heel of a potato sprouting in a paper cup. Sassy sent an avocado seed suspended in a jelly glass by 3 toothpicks, whose stupendous crop of leaves had seen better days. Hessie Mayhew had clearly outdone herself with the offering she sent in a basket that occupied an entire corner of the room. He wanted to pore over every stem and stamen, examine the colors, muse on the fragrances, but he could not. When he occasionally glanced at it, he felt guilty that he didn't care about it in the least, and so stopped looking in that corner. He gave it to Kennedy, who was clearly skeptical. "I've had yards smaller than this," she said, lugging it from the room. He discovered that he was content with the laughter of other patients' visitors along the hall. It was a kind of assurance that people's lives were going on, though his own had come to a bitter halt. He walked down the hall once, without permission, stiff as a board, shuffling like an old person. He was old, of course. He was nearly 70. When he was young, 70 had been old, hadn't it? One of his grandfathers had died at the age of 70, and surely no one had said, "Poor Yancey, he was so young." He noticed that several people stared at him as he scuffed along in his slippers, as if toilet tissue might be trailing from one of the soles. At least 2 people, whom he'd met casually, lowered their eyes and appeared not to recognize him. He knew some of the patients, certainly, and most of the nurses. As rector of Lord's Chapel, he'd come here nearly every weekday morning for 16 years, yet today nothing seemed familiar. He might have been a stranger in the place he'd once spent hours praying with patients and staff, and reading the word by countless bedsides. He barely made it to the rubber plant at the elevators when Kennedy found him and hauled him back to his room as if he were a convict who'd gone over the wall. "No wonder people die in hospitals," he muttered to the long-time head nurse. "They never let you have any fun." "I have come home." He wrote these words on a blank page in the back of his journal, intending to say more, but discovered there was nothing else to say. It was all he had wanted, and then some, just to come home. Thinking he should date the entry, he picked up the pen and held it for a moment, then put it down and looked out the window to the postage-stamp view of Baxter Park. They should tear down the old garage and open up the view. He had no idea why they'd never thought of it before. Even the straggly hedge behind it, which belonged to the town, could be cleaned up to some extent, and dead wood pulled out. In only a couple of days, he and Harley could get the job done, no problem. They would use the chainsaw as needed. He'd stack brush and put it out for the town chipper, and voila, a view of Baxter Park. "What do you think, old boy?" Barnabas jumped from the slip-covered chair by the sofa, came to him, and looked soulfully into his eyes. He started to rise from the chair, but found he hadn't the strength or will to actually do it. The thought of pulling down the garage and cleaning up the hedge had nearly finished him. No more emails, and especially from Father Roland, he heard Cynthia tell Emma at the front door. He needs rest. Emma's words were muffled, but his wife's were sharp and clear, even though she lowered her voice. No more anything for a while. Emma's muffled voice, obviously cranky. I'm sure he wants to see you, too, but doctor's orders are doctor's orders. Call me on Monday. I'll give you a report. The front door closed, and his wife came down the hallway, his dog behind her at a trot. Why couldn't he see Emma? Besides, he was starting to like email. He didn't want to personally be online, for heaven's sake, but he liked the little sheaf of papers Emma brought every week, found them a wonder, truth be told. What about Father What's-His-Name in England? What was he up to? And Father Harry, had he received the check, or had last Thursday's flood kept the mail truck out of the cove? Since no one seemed to write regular letters anymore, how would he ever know anything? And, of course, there was Marion Fieldwalker. Though just getting started at the business of email, she promised to be a positive encyclopedia of news from Whitecap, a place he'd found himself missing more than once. "Guess who's coming today, dearest?" Cynthia stood behind his chair and kissed the top of his head. He wanted to say something bright and clever, but couldn't come up with anything. "Dooley!" Barnabas barked at her announcement. "He'll be here at 3 o'clock. He was terribly worried about you. He wanted to visit the hospital, but Hoppy—blast Hoppy!" he muttered. "Hoppy is dropping in after lunch, by the way." "Why?" "To talk." Seems to me he had plenty to say at the hospital. He's leaving for his trip out west, and wanted to go over some things with you. Where's Puny? I've given her a few days off. Something was up with his wife. He didn't know what. She seemed tense, distracted, worn. Perhaps it was all she'd been through. Then again, perhaps it was something more. "Uh-oh," she said, looking at the clock on his desk. "I'm off to the local. Dooley's coming. You know what that means." She kissed his cheek and dashed from the room, grabbing her car keys off the kitchen island. "I'll bring you a surprise," she called over her shoulder. "No surprises, please," he thought. "Anything but another surprise." "Father?" Hoppy sat in their study, looking anxious and exhausted. Any improvement Father Tim had seen in his doctor 2 days ago had clearly vanished. There was no small talk, no mention of the weather, which was currently sullen with rain, nor any reference to the new study, which Hoppy had never seen until today. "You've been through a dangerous patch. It will take a while to recover your stamina." "Yes," he said. He had the sure sense that an axe was about to fall. His wife sat with him on the sofa and held his hand. He thought she looked unwell. This whole thing had been too much.
"But you're in a familiar place now, with the best nurse in the county outside Kennedy, and I believe you're strong enough to hear what we have to tell you."
But he didn't want to hear anything more.
"When you blacked out at the wheel of your car, you did hit the stop sign at Little Mitford Creek.
If there's any damage, Rodney knows I'll take care of it.
You also hit Bill Sprouse."
He looked at his wife, disbelieving, and saw that all color had drained from her face. Her hand tightened on his. "And his dog, Sparky," she whispered. Something like ice formed in his veins.
"Bill is at the hospital with several fractures and a mild concussion. His room was right down the hall from yours."
"I'm sorry, Father."
Everyone knew and loved First Baptist's jovial pastor, who was devoted to his dog, and regularly seen walking Sparky around Mitford.
"What else?" The pounding of his heart was nearly unbearable.
"Sparky was found under the rear wheel of your car. We think he died instantly."
"Lord, have mercy. Christ, have mercy." He put his head in his hands.
"Why didn't you tell me this before?" "We wanted to wait till you were stronger. Not everybody would have handled it this way, but it seemed the best thing to do."
Father Tim had a fleeting thought that this was only a terrible dream.
"Here's the good news. Bill is going to be all right, though he'll need several weeks to rest and heal. They're looking for someone to supply his pulpit."
But no, it was a waking nightmare. Dooley sat with him on the sofa, unspeaking. Barnabas left the slip-covered chair, came to his master, and lay down at his feet. The clock ticked. The hand moved from 3:10 to 3:11.
"I'm sorry," Dooley said at last.
"I know," he replied.
"I would do something if I could."
"I know," he said again.
"I've been praying for you.
Don't stop."
"No, sir, I won't."
"Bill will be all right."
"But his dog."
"Yes, sir."
The hand passed from 3:13 to 3:14. A June breeze poured through the open windows, bearing a scent of rain and leaf mold.
"I'd better go," said Dooley.
"I know." The boy stood. Father Tim looked at him, stricken.
"I love you," Dooley said with courage. His voice shook.
"I love you back," he thought, but could not speak.
He sat in the study as Cynthia, looking disconsolate, went up to bed. He knew he should do something to reassure her, she who had reassured him again and again, but he could not. He took his Bible off his desk and opened it to 2 Corinthians, and closed his eyes and prayed for Bill Sprouse and his wife. Afterward, he sat with the Bible in his lap for a long time, praying again. Then he lifted the book into the warm circle of light from the lamp. Though he knew the passage by heart, he wanted to see it in print.
"My grace is sufficient for thee,"
he read, barely whispering the words.
"For my strength is made perfect in weakness."
Chapter 8 Tender Mercies. Unlike the arrival of spring, which in Mitford always seemed dilatory,
Summer came this year precisely on time. On the day of solstice, the weather changed as if driven by a calendar date, and temperatures rocketed into the high 80s from the previous day's low 70s. Hesse Mayhew's deck, which was known to enjoy cool breezes from the west, became by noon a veritable broiler, and Hesse an unwilling capon, as she arranged flowers for a wedding at the Methodist chapel. Rescuing buckets of roses, wild larkspur, yellow heliopsis, and Madonna lilies from the perilous heat, she dumped the whole shebang in her kitchen, regretful that her screened porch was currently a storage bin with no room to skin a cat. She absolutely despised working a wedding in a kitchen the size of a cocktail napkin, but more than that, she hated what rode in on her plant materials. Caterpillars, spiders, beetles, mosquitoes, gnats, aphids, bees, inchworms, ladybugs, creatures too weird and disgusting to identify, and, depending on the season, chiggers and fleas. Feeling rivulets of sweat streaming down her spine, she opened the refrigerator door to cool her backside and declared aloud to the Kenmore stove that this was it. This was her last year to be every Tom, Dick, and Harry's step-and-fetch-it flower arranger. She was getting out of the business once and for all, and, come hell or high water, was prepared to let Social Security show her what it was made of. And another thing, that ridiculous Lady Spring column, which she'd slaved over every year for 10 years, was history. She'd done the first on a lark, after forcing herself to read Wordsworth and Cooper and all those other old poets who liked to hang around in the country searching for violets and stuffing their pockets with nuts. When she saw what a kick Father Tim got out of it, she did it another year, then another and another, until she was practically senseless, and all for a measly $15 a clip, which J.C. Hogan appeared to regard as a cool million after taxes. Hesse yanked up her dress and tucked the hem into the legs of her underpants, so that she assumed overall the look of a mushroom turned upside down on its stem. All these years of scrambling for her livelihood, running around like a chicken with its head cut off, and still no air conditioner, not even a window unit. And here it was, getting hotter and hotter in the mountains every blessed summer. Gone were the days when people sometimes wore a sweater in August. Hesse jabbed the rubber stopper into the drain of her kitchen sink and turned on the tap. Some people said all this weather mess was the greenhouse effect. Pretty soon the icebergs would be melting in the north and the terrible floods hurtling in this direction, which meant that once again the south would be taking the brunt of things. Rankled by the doomed and unfair outcome of fuel emissions, she plunged the stems of 47 lilies into the tepid water. "Drink up," she commanded. At that moment, she realized she'd never heard a single civilized word from Father Cavanaugh about the garden basket she sent to his hospital room nearly 3 weeks past. She'd certainly heard straight back from Rachel Sprouse about the lovely vase of yellow roses. She grabbed a coffee mug and smashed a worm on the countertop. What was the matter with people these days? Had common courtesy gone completely out the window? People nattered on about their sex lives till they were blue in the face, but there was scarcely a soul left standing who'd bother to say a simple please or thank you. On the other hand, she was stunned at the thought. Had she really taken the father a basket, or had she dreamed it? Had she planned it so carefully in every detail that she only imagined she'd done it? To tell the truth, she couldn't remember delivering it. And no wonder. Since the middle of May, she'd made so many garden baskets, slogged to the hospital so many times, and done flowers for so many weddings, that it all seemed a blur.
A dull heaviness settled on her heart. Poor Father Cavanaugh, with everything that had happened to him, and not a civilized word from Hessie Mayhew. She felt like the worm she'd just sent to its reward. A few blocks south, Uncle Billy Watson carried a packet of seeds and a rusted hoe to the backyard of the town museum. He liked the way the seeds rustled in their colorful packet. The sound encouraged him in what he was about to do. The dad-jing things had cost a dollar at Dora Pugh's hardware, and he'd made such a fuss about the price, she gave him an old pack from last year's inventory, warning him they may not germinate. But don't come crying to her about it. What he was out to accomplish was a beautification plan for the town museum, since the town was too trifling to do the beautifying themselves. He would show them what a man with a little get-up-and-go could do, which ought to put the whole lot of the town crew to shame. Before long, people would be driving by and taking notice, like they did down at Preacher Cavanaugh's place every summer, those pink roses blooming up the side of his wife's yellow house. Now that was a sight for sore eyes. He laid the packet on the seat of a rusted metal dinette chair that had sat under the tree for several years, and considered the roots of the tree, which were exceedingly prominent. He'd better not go to digging around tree roots. Lord knows what trouble that might stir up. If he was to mess with that tree, it could end up falling on the house. And this was the side his and Rose's bedroom was on. He moved away from the tree and into the yard, where the tall grass awaited the town crew and their mowing machines 2 days hence. How he would get a patch of this tall grass dug up was more than he could figure, but he was going to do it, and that was that. He raised the hoe and gave the ground a good lick, but the hoe bounced out of his hand and landed 2 feet away. Uncle Billy said a word he hadn't said in a good while, then shuffled over and bent down stiffly to pick it up. "Lord have mercy," he said, wiping the sweat from his eyes. Without returning to the original spot, he gave the ground another good lick, and this time made a dent. The hoe blade turned up a smidgen of earth, as red as a brick, and nearly as hard. Seeing dirt gave him a feeling of confidence. He struck the ground again, but missed the opening he had just created, and scored a second dent several inches from the first. "Dadgummit!" He was having a hard time drawing a breath, and his heart was flipping this way and that, like a fish on a creek bank. Not to mention, he was hot as a depot stove, and no wonder. He was wearing Rose's brother's old wool breeches, which were not only burning him up, but itching him half to death. It was enough to make a man run around buck naked. He considered going to the house and changing clothes, but it was too much trouble. Besides, if he went in, Rose would start harping about this or that, and first thing you know, he'd be hauling out garbage or peeling potatoes or sharpening a knife blade that wouldn't cut butter. She might even send him to the basement for that jar of pickles Lou Boyd had brought a while back, and the thought of all those jumping spiders was enough to make his scalp prickle. No, sir, he was going to knock this thing in the head, and by October, or was it September, they would have a bait of yellow chrysanthemums that a man could see all the way from the town monument. It would be a help if Preacher Cavanaugh would walk by with his dog. The preacher would definitely know the best way to do this job of work, but he hadn't seen the preacher in a good while, owing, he supposed, to the bad thing that had happened. He would go down the street in a day or two and tell him the 2 new jokes he'd learned from one of his almanacs. He would do the same for Preacher Sprouse, but there was no way in creation he could make it up that long hill to what most people called Sprouse House. He took the hoe handle firmly between his arthritic hands, raised it as high as he was able, and whacked the ground with all his might. By Johnny, that did it. A tall stand of grass keeled over, exposing a shallow hole the size of a man's hand. "Hallelujah!" he hollered. He looked toward the house to see if Rose was watching. As far as he could see, which wasn't very far, she wasn't. He decided to sit a minute and catch his breath, but the dad-blamed chair was halfway to China. He dropped the hoe in the grass and hobbled toward the tree, clutching his lower back, where a shooting pain bubbled up like carbonation in a soft drink. He thumped down in the chair on the packet of seeds, wiped his forehead with his sleeve, and considered the satisfying hole he had just dug with only one whack. How many whacks would it take to make room for a handful of seeds? How long would it take to see sprouts? Would he have to build a fence around the bloomin' things to keep the town crew from... He dozed, dreaming of the creek near his boyhood cabin, the creek where he caught his first tadpole and saw his first bear and got bit by a snake. In this dream, however, there were no snakes, just his mama standing in the bend of Little Jack Creek, stooped over and washing out his school breeches and humming Red Wing. At Happy Endings Bookstore, Hope Winchester opened the front door, looked at her watch, then trotted to the rear of the shop and unlocked the back door, which led to the loading dock. She didn't care if the flies came in the back door, which had never had a screen. She would deal with it. She was absolutely craving a breath of cool air. Cross-ventilation. Wasn't that the crux of all important Southern architecture? She slid a box of paperbacks across the floor to hold the back door open, and, satisfied that she might make it until the air conditioning was repaired on Tuesday, returned to her stool by the cash register and picked up her 1913 edition of Aunt Olive in Bohemia, which had mistakenly been shipped with an order of rare and used books. Hope had seen immediately that this was not literature. It was shallow entertainment. But perhaps she should loosen up just this once and read something light and unimportant, which was precisely what most of her customers enjoyed. With the exception, of course, of her good clientele from the college in Wesley, or Mrs. Harper and Lace Turner, and Mr. Gregory, and a sprinkling of others, not to mention her favorite customer, Father Cavanaugh. She sighed, suddenly miserable at the thought of what had happened to him, and how inauspicious the whole dreadful thing had been. She wished she could do something to help, but there was nothing she could do. Two people had told her they were praying for him, and suggested she might do the same. But she didn't believe in prayer. She was a lifelong friend of optimism and reason. She had succeeded in avoiding her deepest feelings all morning, as they served only to inspire a wild swing between morbid anxiety and sheer exhilaration. Indeed, she would concentrate her energies on reading this innocuous book, keeping the shop cool, and satisfying the needs of her customers, should she have one. Whatever she did, she would make a strict and disciplined effort to keep firm control of her imagination, which had always been wayward and fitful, a problem, according to her mother, caused by too much reading. She glanced at her watch again and opened the book to chapter 3. It was nearly 7 o'clock in the evening, and through one of the windows of the newly furnished studio a shaft of sunlight had found its way. It formed a patch of light on the blue drugget on the floor, and caught the corner of an oak dresser on which the old Worcester dinner service was arranged. Hope thought the imagery deft enough, and liked very much the word drugget, which she'd never before seen or heard. It must surely be a rug, but as she'd never learned anything by guessing, she put the book down and hurried to the dictionary on the little stand by the front door, placed there for customers to peruse at their leisure. A rug from India of coarse hair with cotton or jute. She felt the breeze then, so cool and sweet against the back of her neck, that she let down her guard and closed her eyes and found herself standing on a moor in England, her long dark cape snapping in the wind, and George Gaynor riding toward her on a gray steed. "Good morning, Miss Winchester. I hope it's all right if I'm early." She shot awake from her dream, burning with mortification and alarmed by the uncontrolled pounding of her heart. She was struck dumb before the tall, lean silhouette of George Gaynor standing in the shop door, the light shining behind him. Helene Pringle stood at the upstairs bedroom window in what had once served as the rectory for the chapel of our Lord and Saviour, otherwise known as Lord's Chapel. She felt terribly perplexed and anxious, on pins and needles, really, trying to decide what might be proper. Should she go next door and pay her respects, and possibly be thought intrusive at this sensitive time, or wait until things were back to normal, and perhaps be thought cold and uncaring for not calling sooner? She had always been a worrier, and often found herself torn between complete opposites of choice and affection. Before and after piano lessons and visits to her mother at Hope House, she had been glued to this window, thinking she may find some clue to what was transpiring at the Cavanaughs. But the yellow house next door might have been a sepulchre. She had seen Mrs. Cavanaugh only once, dashing from her front door in robe and pajamas, picking up the newspaper and running in again. Since the Muse was delivered on Tuesday, and this was Saturday, it had literally been days since she'd witnessed movement. Of course, she couldn't see the new garage side of the house, where people probably came and went all the time. And certainly nothing could be seen through their upstairs windows, as they were always shuttered on the side facing her own. Her cat, Barbizon, rubbed himself against her ankles, though she took no notice. She couldn't bear this dreadful anxiety another moment, and certainly not another day. How was the dear man? Was his diabetes so advanced that his life might be threatened? Was he grieved beyond telling? As someone of infinite sensitivity, and a dog lover to boot, he would have taken this thing very, very hard. While shopping at the local, she had questioned Avis Packard about Reverend Sprouse, and learned he must endure another several weeks of bed rest, but would recover. Further, Reverend Sprouse was stricken about the loss of his dog, but made every attempt to remain jovial and to lift the spirits of others. She hadn't the courage to inquire about Father Tim, afraid that Mr. Packer might interpret the depths of her concern as odd or extreme. She found that she was wringing her hands, and knew she must put this thing away from her once and for all. It had jangled her nerves most dreadfully, and distracted her attention from her students. "Ça ne va pas," she said aloud, scolding herself. "Bake a loaf of bread if you must, and leave it on their doorstep. Better still, roast a nice poulet." He'd told her he enjoyed roast chicken. "Bien sûr. That solved it, then." Since her youthful faith grew cold years ago, she regretted that she hadn't often prayed. Of course, she must pray at once. She had quite neglected to do this most crucial thing for a man who had, in almost every sense, saved her life. whose tender forgiveness of the wrong she'd done him had resurrected her from a grave of bitterness and guilt. She crossed herself quickly and looked toward the ceiling.
Saint-Père, accorde-moi, s'il te plaît, l'occasion de faire quelque chose pour ton cher émissaire, quelque chose qui fera une différence.
She reflected a moment, then spoke the same words in English.
Holy Father, please give me the opportunity to do something for your dear emissary, something that will make a difference.
She hoped that two separate pleas might be doubly persuasive, yet had no idea at all that she'd been heard. She felt an odd relief, nonetheless, as she straightened the collar of her blouse and pinched her cheeks and walked downstairs to prepare for her next student. In the hallway, she hesitated. Was that a sound from the basement? No, it was a car on the street. Since the man in the attic, as Mitfordians often called him, moved in with Mr. Welch 2 days ago, she thought she might hear uproarious laughter or a great deal of coming and going. In truth, she wouldn't have known another soul was down there if he hadn't come knocking on her door to introduce himself. He'd even invited her to call on him if she needed anything at all. She had thought him attractive, or perhaps comely was a more precise term, and was relieved to see he was clean-shaven, which she supposed was required in prison. He had also been immensely courteous, but of course, if he was going to get ahead in the world, he could hardly afford to be otherwise. On the whole, she had approved, confident that Father Cavanaugh would not send anyone suspicious to live on his own property. She moved toward the music room, thinking, "The man in the attic." She mused on this odd appellation, finding it odder still that George Gaynor was now l'homme au sous-sol. After a meatloaf sandwich and iced coffee for lunch, Esther Bolick lay in her plaid recliner in full repose, listening to the snores of her husband and wondering what she could do for Father Tim. It was hard, very hard, when people couldn't, and in today's world, wouldn't, eat cake. When she was coming up, families lived from cake to cake. A cake was a special event. It meant something. Now a homemade, baked-from-scratch cake meant next to nothing. For one thing, most young people had never experienced such a thing. All they'd ever known was bought from a store and tasted like hamster shavings, or had been emptied from a box into a bowl, stirred with low-fat milk, and shoved into an oven that nearly blew a fuse from being turned on in the first place. Such a cake could never be your cake. No way. It would be Betty Crocker's or Duncan Hines's cake, and the difference between yours and theirs was vast and unforgivable. And look how people acted these days at the mere sight of a piece of cake. Cake? Get it out of here. I'm on a diet. I don't want it in the house. Worse yet was the inevitable declaration, I never touch cake. Never touch cake. Pathetic. The world was increasingly filled with such people, not to mention the crowd that ate cake in secret, stuffing it in their faces when nobody was looking, and claiming to nourish themselves on a diet of boiled eggs and dry toast. She knew who they were. Father Tim was different, of course. Eating cake would not merely add a measly pound or two. It would kill him dead as a doornail. Just look what he'd done to himself with a Coke, or was it a Pepsi? Jean snorted and woke himself up. He raised his head and looked at her inquiringly.
"What did you say, Sugarfoot?"
"Go back to sleep," she snapped, fed up with the whole notion of modern civilization. "And take biscuits. Biscuits had fallen into disgrace, right along with cake. Would anybody eat a biscuit any more? No way. Not on your life. Too fattening. Too much cholesterol. All that white flour. All that shortening. On and on, till you could keel over and croak. She'd been born in the wrong century. She cranked her chair upright, dismounted, and went in the kitchen and jerked open her cabinet doors. Nothing. There was absolutely nothing in this house that the father could eat, except maybe a can of salmon. A card, then. Pitiful though it was the best she could come up with. She had waited till the dust settled on this awful mess before acting, and now was the time to act. It was a new season and a fresh beginning. Father Tim would want to know that people didn't hold anything against him. She went to the downstairs half-bath and ran water over a wash-rag and scrubbed her perspiring face and dried it, then dipped her little finger in the lipstick tube. She had gouged stuff out of there for so long there was hardly a scrap left. She'd get another tube at the drugstore when she went looking for a card. She stretched her lips in a wide grimace and applied the dab of color with her finger. Maybe coral this time, instead of mauve. Mauve made her look washed out. She sighed, hoping she'd be able to find something that would make him laugh. Over the last few days, he'd had the odd impression of a recent visit with Miss Sadie. There was some fresh, instinctive connection to her that he hadn't experienced since her death. Perhaps he'd dreamed. Father Tim sat at his desk, looking out to the space where the garage had stood. He was surprised by two extremes of feeling. He would miss seeing the moss on the roof tiles and the nest the swallows were building with daubs of mud. At the same time, the opening of the view gave him a sense of liberty he realized he'd been craving. He watched George Gaynor toss a couple of old boards into the bed of Harley's truck, as Harley swigged Gatorade from a plastic bottle. He'd mentioned to Harley his sudden inspiration about tearing out the garage, a project they might do together when he was feeling stronger. The next thing he knew, the two men were at work, fulfilling his vision within hours of the telling. With Harley's clean-up of the hedge, Father Tim could see into Baxter Park as if with new eyes. The labor of yesterday and today had revealed a corner of the park grounds he'd never especially noticed, including a red maple that spread its branches over summer grass that, even in today's sultry heat, appeared cool and inviting. He felt his dog move at his feet. "Good fellow," he whispered, the lump coming again to his throat. What would he have done if someone had, if the same thing had happened to Barnabas? He looked down into the dark and soulful eyes from which he'd drawn consolation for so many years, eyes that sometimes seemed a window into the depths of his own soul. Had Bill Sprouse known this mysterious and consoling connection with Sparky? Of course. And it had been violently wrenched from him. Cynthia came into the room and stood by his chair, watching George toss another board onto the truck bed. "A blessing," she said. "A blessing, yes." She leaned down and kissed the top of his head. "God is good." "Yes," he replied, "God is good." He heard her leave the room and wanted to turn around and watch her go, but he could not. "Barnabas," Cynthia called, jingling the leash, "monument time." Barnabas rose slowly and trotted to the kitchen, where Cynthia snapped on the worn red leash. "Back in 10, dearest. Then I'm dashing to the Sprouses with a tuna casserole." They were gone along the hall and out the front door. He sat as if frozen. At least a month of rest, Hoppy had said. Now 3 weeks had gone by, and he hadn't recovered an ounce of strength. In truth, he couldn't even walk his dog. Perhaps he'd ask Dr. Wilson about his medication. Perhaps it wasn't doing the job. He resented Hoppy's absence, he who had urged his doctor year after year to take a vacation. He glanced at the open journal on his desk and the quote from Thomas A. Kempis, which he'd inscribed early this morning. "Great tranquillity of heart is his who cares for neither praise nor blame." He had no tranquillity of heart. The blame that he felt from himself and imagined from others was corrosive. He regretted, in some perverse way, that Bill Sprouse would not sue him. "I'm not a suing man," Bill had said when they spoke on the phone. "Dare any of you, having a matter against another, go to law before the unjust and not before the saints? Saint Paul said it, and I trust it. Then over in Luke we're told, 'As ye would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise.' The Lord himself said it, and I trust it. Besides, I wouldn't want you suing me for something I couldn't help. You couldn't help it, brother. Let up on yourself." "I'll be over to see you as soon as I can," he had said, mopping his eyes. Bill had laughed. "Whichever cripple is the first to get up and around calls on the other one. How's that?" "Deal. God bless you, Timothy." "And you, my friend." "You couldn't help it," Bill had said. But he could have helped it. He could have helped it by not cutting back on the insulin, by buying another glucometer and using it, by not skipping meals, by sticking to his exercise, by drinking water instead of sugar-loaded soda. But he couldn't say that to anyone. He couldn't utter the horrific truth that he had been that day like a loose cannon, that indeed he could have helped it. The rabbits. He still thought about his little herd, and how they had been seemingly well one day, and dead the next, every one of them. He would never forget his father's wrath, the conviction that his son had done nothing to prevent the wasteful crime of their loss, and the useless drain on the family finances. Yes, he had noticed some listlessness in several of the does, but he hadn't known it was anything serious. He hadn't known he could help it. He watched Harley's truck pull out of view. He was headed to the dump, where, for $15 a load, a garage built more than 70 years ago would vanish from the face of the earth. If only. He realized he'd sat here like a stone for what seemed to be hours, and stood, stiff in every joint. He wanted his wife, her softness, her breath on his cheek, her warmth, her benediction. He went slowly up the stairs and into their bedroom, and began to turn back the bedspread. When had he ever gone to bed in the afternoon? Even when he'd had the flu a time or two, he'd toughed it out on the sofa. He wanted to stop turning back the covers, but he could not. He undressed, noting for the first time that he'd buckled his belt differently, and that his pants were surprisingly loose-fitting. Then he hung his clothes in the closet and put on his pajamas. The whole thing seemed to take a long time. He lay down then, and pulled the sheet over him, and waited for his wife, ashamed for her to find him like this, yet eager for her touch. "Timothy?" she said, standing in the doorway. He couldn't see her face and read her thoughts about his lying in bed like a sluggard. He wanted desperately to please her. Perhaps she would forgive him. She came into the room and sat on the side of the bed. He was relieved to see no judgment in her eyes, only concern. "Dearest?" "Come," he said, drawing back the sheet. With all his heart, with all his soul, and with all his might, he wanted to reassure and gratify his wife. And yet, when she lay down beside him and embraced him, he could not. "Save me, O God, for the waters are come in unto my soul. I sink in deep mire, where there is no standing. I am come into deep waters, where the floods overflow me. I am weary of my crying. My throat is dried, mine eyes fail, while I wait for my God. O God, thou knowest my foolishness, and my sins are not hid from thee. My prayer is unto thee, O Lord, in an acceptable time. O God, in the multitude of thy mercy, hear me. Hear me, O Lord, for thy loving kindness is good. Turn unto me according to the multitude of thy tender mercies. And hide not thy face from thy servant, for I am in trouble. Hear me speedily. Draw nigh unto my soul and redeem it. Deliver me because of mine enemies. Thou hast known my reproach and my shame and my dishonor. Mine adversaries are all before thee. Pour out thine indignation upon them, and let thy wrathful anger take hold of them." He sat in the pool of lamplight at 3 in the morning, Barnabas at his feet. He was praying the Psalms, as he'd done in times past, with the enemies of King David translated into his own enemies of fear and remorse and self-loathing, which in their legions had become as armies of darkness. Chapter 9. Touching God. He'd put off returning the calls of 2 priests who wanted to give him communion. He'd also put off calling Dr. Wilson, but his wife had not. Her end of the conversation could be heard through the open door of her workroom. Obviously, she didn't mind being overheard, though he missed some of it. "It's dreadful. And he never laughs, which is so unlike him." "Yes, possibly. Well, almost certainly. Little appetite, though I've been..." "Favorite things. Quite thin. Thank you, Doctor. What a blessing that you'll come." "Yes, hardly enough energy to get out of the chair." She came into the study and announced that Dr. Wilson would be dropping by after 5 o'clock. "And since tomorrow is your birthday, dearest, I thought we might have a little party." "No," he said. "Please, I don't want a party." "I understand. But you'll love it, Timothy. Trust me." He wanted to trust her. "Depression," said Dr. Wilson. "And please don't think it's unusual after what you've been through." Depression. The word impacted him like a ton of bricks. He loathed the very thought of such a thing snaring him. Depression was everyone else's problem. He was clergy. He was... "Depression usually stems from anger turned inward. I'm no psychologist, but I suggest you look at what the anger is about. Getting to the root of it could help." His blood surged in a kind of fury. "We're going to change your medication, but more important, I want you to start seeing people. Perhaps you could have a few friends in to visit." "I don't want to see anyone," he snapped. "That's all well and good, Father, but it's doctor's orders for you to have a bit of company." That was the trouble with Wilson. He acted like he ran things when Hoppy was out of town. Before Hoppy went tooting off to heaven knows where, it was doctor's orders that I not have company. Wilson grinned. That was then, Father. This is now. He smelled coffee and opened his eyes. Happy birthday, sweetheart. His wife put the tray on the bedside table and kissed his face, his nose, his chin, the tender spot where he'd banged his head. He didn't sit up. I'm sorry, he said. Sorry that I can't be more, that I can't be everything you need. But you are everything I need, she said. This will pass away, Timothy. This difficult time is not for all eternity. Remember our good verse from Jeremiah. I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord, plans for good and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. Yes. I don't understand him, Timothy. If I did, would he be God? I believe that everything that happens must pass God's muster, and that somehow he permitted this. He is very present and working in our lives. Yes. But sometimes you forget it. She handed him a steaming mug. He nodded. I'm praying that he will use this hard thing for good. I mean, after all, darling, look what he did for the Israelites. Right. But he didn't have 40 years. You're going to have fun today. Do I have to? He couldn't believe the whine he heard in his voice. It was nauseating. Preacher? Bill Watson shuffled into the study. Though obviously nervous, he revealed his gold tooth in a broad smile. Don't get up now. He came and stood before his former priest, bowed slightly, and shook his hand. Happy birthday, don't you know? Thank you, Uncle Billy. Bill Watson's hand was as dry as a corn shuck in winter. Sit down, my friend. His one-time parishioner sat opposite him in the leather wing chair. Early afternoon light from a long bay of windows dappled the old man's face. Rose couldn't come. She was peeling taters for supper. Uh-huh. How are you faring these days? Fair to middling. I was sitting in my chair this morning when all of a sudden I felt something, don't you know. Like what? Itching. The worst kind. What it was, I had broke out in whelps. Something you ate? No, sir. It's working a garden that done it. You're working a garden? He wanted to lie down on the floor and expire. How many people had Cynthia invited? He was already exhausted. Mostly I'm breaking new ground. I ain't started planting yet. He racked his brain for small talk, but found nothing. He heard his wife in the kitchen and the sound of the doorbell. Another shift coming on. Uncle Billy cleared his throat. I've come to tell a joke for your birthday. Is that right? Yes, sir. I've studied out two for you. To keep his legs from trembling with the excitement of what he was about to do, Uncle Billy clasped his knees. I appreciate it, said Father Tim. He would have given anything to have squirmed out of this social event. In cahoots with Wilson, Cynthia had arranged to have a few people drop by to deliver birthday greetings. They were to be shown into the study one at a time, so he wouldn't be overstimulated. He felt like a clinical experiment. They might have dolled him up in a white jacket. And all the while, Hoppy Harper was tooling along the Oregon Trail in ostrich hide boots, and couldn't care less about his patients in Mitford. Uncle Billy straightened his tie and coughed, then got down to business.
"Well, sir, they was two fellers a-workin' on the sawmill, don't you know, and the first un got too close to the saw and cut his ear off. Well, it fell in the sawdust pit, and he was down there a-tryin' to find it, don't you know. The other feller said, 'What are you a-doin' down there?' First un said, 'I cut my ear off, and I'm a-lookin' for it.' The other feller jumped in the pit, said, 'I'll help you.' Got down on his hands and knees, went to looking around, hard, 'Here it is, I done found it.' First feller, he took it and give it the once over, don't you know. Said, 'Keep a looking. Mine had a pencil behind it.'"
Father Tim tried to laugh. A sound like the creaking of a gate on a rusty hinge escaped before he could choke it back. He saw the pained look on the old man's face.
"Didn't go over too good, did it?"
"I'm sorry, Uncle Billy. It's a good joke. Really, it is."
"No, it ain't,"
said Uncle Billy, obviously stricken. Father Tim burned with shame. He knew what a desperate task Uncle Billy faced in coming up